You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on the Useless Information Retrocast, you'll hear about a 1947 battle over whether or not women should be employed as toll collectors. And then you'll find out about a man who died in 1913 but wasn't buried until 1973. Just what were they doing with his body for those 60 years? Plus, you'll learn about an alligator who ended up living in a California swamp, which of course is not even close to its native habitat. Well, all those stories, the question of the day, today's retro sponsor, and so much more. It's coming up next on today's edition of the Useless Information Retrocast. I am Steve Silverman, and this is the Useless Information Podcast.
Useless information.
Hey everyone, I hope you're doing well, and thanks for joining me. Today, I'm thrilled to present to you what I consider a marvelous retrocast. Now, for those of you who are new to the space and may not be acquainted with the podcast, allow me to provide a brief introduction. You see, these are the shorter stories that I come across while researching the longer ones that I typically tell. So, without further ado, let's dive right into today's collection of true stories. And first up, we have a story that I titled, A Cold-Blooded Mystery Solved. On Sunday, July 25th, 1926, Detective Lieutenant John Adams of the University Police Station in Los Angeles was driving near a swampy area in the Santa Ana Canyon in California. To his surprise, he spotted an alligator approximately 42 inches in length, that's about 106.7 centimeters, and weighing around 50 pounds or 22.7 kilograms. It was just sunbathing along the side of the road. After a strenuous struggle, Adams was able to capture the creature by placing a small rope around its neck. He then transported the alligator to his home and provided it with a small pond to frolic in. An examination of the stripes of the alligator's tail suggests that it was 17 or 18 years old, but modern scientific research has concluded that the beast was far younger than this. What does that really mean? I did an internet search. An alligator of that length is probably just a few years old. Of course, a couple of questions quickly arose. I mean, first, how did an alligator, which is not native to the West Coast of the United States, end up in California? And if there's one alligator there, could there be more in that swamp? Well, this reptilian mystery would be solved the very next day. Los Angeles Dr. G.A. Bullard, who once lived near the location where the alligator was found, read the story in the newspaper and immediately recognized the creature. He said that he obtained the alligator while attending a convention in New Orleans 4 years earlier. At the time, it measured about 1 foot or 30.5 centimeters in length, and he gave it the name Al I period Gator, Al middle initial I Gator, or Al I Gator. And he decided to bring it home. There was one major obstacle in his plan to raise this cold-blooded animal, and that is that his mother strongly objected to him doing so. Unfortunately, this left him with just one option. On a moonlit night, he released Al into a secluded pool in the canyon. And Dr. Bullard forgot about his pet until he read about its capture. He said that he did not want the alligator back, but he did plan to make a visit to see if it still recognized him. And the press just dropped the story there, so we have no idea if Al actually recognized Dr. Bullard. And I just want to point out that the next story involves a little bit of sexism, and the one after that, a little bit of racism. And this first one is titled, The Bay Bridge Battle of the Sexes. When the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge opened on Thursday, November 12th of 1936, the toll was set at 65 cents. Now, I know that sounds like a bargain, but if you adjust for inflation, that's $14.51 today. But that wasn't all. They also charged an additional 5 cents or $1.12 today per passenger. And that was for just one way of travel. Decide to head back over the bridge and your cost doubles. Wow. Yet by 1941, it was realized that there was no need to charge as much. So the toll was reduced to 25 cents per direction. That's about $5.28. And that's because they felt that was sufficient enough to cover the bonds that were taken out to fund construction. And it would stay at this price all the way up through 1969. Well, of course, today the tolls are collected electronically, but that wasn't the case when the bridge opened. Back then, toll booths at both ends of the bridge were staffed by a 100% male workforce. And that worked well until World War II broke out. Suddenly, you have a shortage of male workers, so the State Personnel Board had no choice but to hire women to collect the tolls. But when the war was over, the men wanted the women gone. Toll collecting was tough, and it was felt that women simply weren't up to the demands of the job. Well, it all came to a head in January of 1947. That's when representatives of the male employees penned a 4-page letter to the personnel board, and it demanded that the next civil service examination, which was scheduled to be administered on February 8th, be restricted to men only. The letter was signed by 65 male collectors and read, in part, quote, "We strongly protest the placing of an unfair additional burden on the shoulders of the men toll collectors by employing women," unquote. A story in the January 30, 1947 publication of the Oakland Tribune offered up the opinions of some of those involved. J.A. Grant, a red-headed ex-Marine First Lieutenant who resided at 3246 San Pablo Avenue, summed up the opinion of many of the men. He said that a
woman's place is in the home.
In response, Hazel Howard of 3808 West Street said,
"We were good enough to do this work when you men were off at war."
E.M. Carroll, who had been collecting quarters on the bridge for 6 years, stated, quote,
"This isn't a woman's job. 14 automobiles a minute. We have to be peace officers as well. Imagine women on the police force."
He added,
"It's the pay. It starts at $220 and goes to $260. That's good for a woman."
Adjusted for inflation, a range of $220 to $260 is around $3,000 to $3,600 today, although there's no mention if that was for a week, 2 weeks, a month, or even a year. Probably not a year. Sergeant Harry Burke, who had been collecting tolls since the bridge opened, noted that the women did a good job while the men were off fighting the war. But he said,
"We don't need them anymore. It's one of the toughest jobs going. It's tedious with long, erratic hours, and women can't maintain the standard of accuracy."
One of the female toll collectors was Mrs. Juanita Merriam, who noted,
"We do everything the men do."
Yet her husband was one of those who signed the petition demanding that women be forbidden from collecting the tolls. Carl S. Hamilton, a bridge maintenance engineer, acted as spokesperson for his staff.
"We're very grateful for the women's work during the war under trying circumstances. There are certain phases of work women can't fulfill with drunken and obstreperous patrons. They can't handle barricades and cash registers, and men have to do that work. During the war, some patrons tried to take advantage of the women who had to put up with a lot of guff from roughnecks."
So on February 1st of 1947, the State Personnel Board met in San Francisco to hear evidence from both sides. In addition to their previously mentioned complaints, the men added that the women had excessive absenteeism during bad weather and that they made numerous errors in giving customers change during peak hours. And just who won the Bay Bridge Battle of the Sexes? Well, the men, of course. the board ruled that the women would not be allowed to take the civil service exam. In addition, all but one of the women needed to leave their jobs by June 30th of that year. That one woman who was allowed to keep her position, that's because she had already obtained permanent civil service status. Back in 1973, Mrs. L.G. Pace found herself in a bit of a pickle. You see, she had just lost her job as a licensed vocational nurse at the Dallas County Mental Evaluation Center, or MEC for short, and that's because she spoke up about the horrific conditions there. Now, just briefly, the MEC was a short-term facility that was used to determine if those with alcohol, drug, or emotional problems should be committed to a state mental hospital. She said,
"There are no beds at MEC. Just green mats like wrestlers use scattered on the floor of cells once used to house criminals. And no toilets, just holes in the ground for men and women alike. Roaches crawl everywhere and sick patients are allowed to wallow in their own bowel movement and urine. It's one of the dirtiest, filthiest places you'll ever see."
But being a crusading nurse was not the reason that LG made national headlines. Instead, it was because the widowed mother of five had kept a mummified man in her basement for 5 years. So you're probably wondering how a dead man ended up in her cellar. Well, the story begins in November 1913 when a one-legged vagabond named Anderson McCrew was riding a freight train through Marlin, which is located in central Texas. He accidentally fell from the train, lost his other leg, and sadly died shortly after that. He was taken to a nearby funeral home where Undertaker James Washington embalmed the body. And the plan was to preserve McCrew just long enough so that a family member could come and claim him. But no relative ever appeared. It's unclear how, but at some point, Anderson McCrew's body became part of a carnival, and he donned a brown tuxedo and was marketed as the Petrified Man and the Eighth Wonder of the World. As LG told Jet Magazine in July 1973,
"The carnival showed him off in a black box. Some of my friends say they remember seeing him."
When the carnival ran into financial troubles in the early 1960s, it was forced to sell off many of its possessions, and that included McCrew's mummified remains. And what happened next is a bit murky, but soon LG found herself in possession of the body. And not knowing his real name, she called him Sam.
"I came across Sam 5 years ago. He was in a warehouse that was on my sister-in-law's place. There were chickens roosting on his coffin. My sister-in-law said she was going to put the coffin in a ditch and throw dirt over it. Even though he was black, I felt he deserved a decent Christian burial, so I put the coffin in the trunk of my car, and I've kept the mummy in my basement since then."
The Jet reporter questioned LG as to why she would keep the man's body in her basement if her only rationale for taking possession of McCrew was to provide him with a proper burial. She replied,
"I'm a working widow. I had no money to bury him. I called the medical school, but nobody wanted the body. And one time I thought about putting the body on display at a mortuary charging $1 to see him. I was going to use the money collected to bury him. He's a human being. You just can't throw a body into a ditch."
When the story first appeared in the newspapers in late May 1973, LG was still between jobs, but she had not given up on her determination to purchase a burial plot for Sam. Believe it or not, she was contemplating the sale of her house to raise funds to do so, and that's when Frank Lott, the proprietor of Lott's Mortuary in Dallas, learned of the story. He said,
"He was in pretty good shape. A lot of the tissue was still on his face. We don't know of any living relatives."
Lott did offer to bury him free of charge. It was through an examination of records in Marlin that Sam finally was identified as Anderson McCrew. Lott said that his body had originally been kept in one of the upstairs rooms of that Marlin funeral home. But with no one to claim his body, he was mummified by pumping concentrated preservation solutions throughout his body for several days. It was also learned that McCrew's little dog died just a short time after he did. The pooch was also mummified, and the funeral home placed its body right next to his deceased owner. But no one knows what happened to the dog after McCrew was sold off to the carnival. Lott added,
I guess if you were the wrong color back then, they didn't bother to keep thorough files on you.
Services were held in Lott's Chapel beginning at 2:30 p.m. on Saturday, May 26 of 1973. Shortly after this, Anderson McCrew was finally laid to rest in a grave located in Dallas's Lincoln Memorial Cemetery. And normally that would have been the end of the story. But wait, there's more. That's because singer-songwriter Don McLean, who's probably best known for his hit songs American Pie and Vincent, he read of McCrew's story and penned the song The Legend of Andrew McCrew. I should point out it's unclear why he changed the first name from Anderson to Andrew, but it really doesn't matter in the story. The song proved popular on Chicago radio station WGN, and that prompted radio host Roy Leonard to contact LG. As a result, she appeared on his show with McLean, and Bob Williams of the Jensen Corporation of Chicago offered to pick up the cost of a headstone. So on December 8th of 1974, a second ceremony was held at his grave, and that was for the laying of Anderson McCrew's headstone. Inscribed on it is a portion of the song's lyrics, quote, "Well, what a way to live a life and what a way to die. Left to live a living death with no one left to cry. A petrified amazement, a wonder beyond worth. A man who found more life in death than life gave him at birth." The names of LG Pace and Don McLean, as well as WGN Chicago and Phelps Monuments, are all carved into the stone. There's also a marker placed at the foot of his grave, and that reads, quote, "Anderson McCrew, the mummified man. Born 1869, died 1913, buried 1973. Traveled for 60 years after death as a circus attraction," unquote. I just want to add that there is a video of this dedication ceremony on YouTube, so what I'll do is I'll place a link to it along with the text of the story on my website, uselessinformation.org. And it is worth checking out, both to see the crowd that attended and also to see what Anderson McCrew's mummified body looked like. And while it's not stated, my assumption is that the woman sitting in the front row is LG Pace with her children right next to her. Check it out.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
So here's a question for you. According to Billboard, what was the biggest hit song that Elvis Presley ever had on their Top 100 or Hot 100 singles chart? And if you know anything about Elvis, it's probably a pile of songs running through your head. Anyway, I'm going to let you ponder over that question for a bit, and I'll let you know the answer at the end of this podcast.
Mutual, your network for news, presents ace commentators, reporters, and analysts with last-minute news information at all hours, day and evening throughout the week. With events in far-off corners of the world having an impact on us here at home equal to that of domestic issues, it becomes more necessary than ever to listen to informed newsmen who speak from a background of experience. The world is getting smaller. Our neighbors are much closer to us than ever before. But at the same time, the lives of our neighbors affect us more directly than when distance was a natural barrier. To sort out, to clarify, to turn the spotlight on the really vital news stories of the moment is the job that Mutual's Corps of News Experts does for you. Commentary from varying viewpoints, thought-provoking and stimulating analysis, interpretation of current events by men who make it their business to get the facts and get them straight. Regardless of your choice, you can hear news as you like it on Mutual. And say, don't forget, you can take your choice of when you want to hear it, too. There are news reports in all forms at all hours of the day or evening throughout the week on Mutual over most of these same stations.
That promo for the Mutual Network news programs is from the May 4th, 1953 broadcast of The Jack Kirkwood Show. It was a comedy show that starred, can you guess who? Jack Kirkwood. Amazing, huh? Anyway, it starred Jack Kirkwood, who gained fame for playing second banana to Bob Hope on The Bob Hope Show. And if I could rename this podcast, I guess it'd be The Steve Silverman Show. Nah, bad move. Anyway, Kirkwood was Scottish-born and came to the U.S. in the 1920s. He began his career in vaudeville and then transitioned to radio, television, and film. Sadly, he passed away from a heart attack on August 2nd in 1964 at the age of 69. As for the Mutual Network itself, it began in 1934 as a cooperative venture between four radio stations. They were WOR in Newark, New Jersey, WGN in Chicago, WXYZ in Detroit, and WLW in Cincinnati. But unlike CBS and the NBC Red and Blue networks, which of course were corporate-controlled with network-produced programming, Mutual stations were different. They just shared their content among others in their network. By December of 1948, Mutual had expanded to over 500 stations across the United States. But I should point out that their market share was still small, and that's because the bulk of these stations were in smaller markets with weaker signals. The larger, more powerful stations, you know, the one with significant audiences, they had all been gobbled up previously by those bigger corporate networks. But a smaller market share didn't stop Mutual from launching some of the classic radio shows. These included The Shadows starring Orson Welles, Queen for a Day, and Meet the Press, which of course is now a staple of NBC's Sunday morning programming. And in later years, the Mutual Network found success in talk radio, and they made Larry King a star. But as they say, nothing lasts forever. Mutual would change hands many times, lastly becoming part of Westwood One in 1985. They would eventually phase out the Mutual name, and the network ceased to exist at midnight on April 17th of 1999. Next up, we have five footnotes of history, and these are just the shorter tidbits that I come across, and they really require no further research, so I'm simply going to read them word for word as they're originally published. And our first story appeared on page one of the January 8th, 1904 edition of the Salina Daily Union. The headline reads, Chewing Gum Party, Mrs. W.H. Kaur entertained friends in a novel manner. Mrs. W.H. Kaur entertained a few friends Wednesday evening at a chewing gum party. Cards and gum were passed to the guests, and with their gum they would make representation of some animal and stand it on the card. Mrs. G.T. Wells molded the best specimen, and to her was given the royal prize, a candle and candle holder. As Charles Kaur succeeded just a little worse than the others, he was given the booby prize, a package of gum with which he was to practice in order that he could make a better animal next time. Those present, Mr. and Mrs. Anderson, Charles Kaur, J.T. Wells, E.J. Williams, and W.H. Kaur. Sounds like a bit of a sticky mess, doesn't it? And next up, we have another sticky story. This one is from the Lansing State Journal on July 5th, 1932. It appeared on page 3. The headline reads, Rain of Lollipops at Children Party. Philadelphia, July 5th, Associated Press. Childhood's wish for a mountain of ice cream was matched with one that came true Monday when it rained lollipops upon some 900 youthful campers at Camp Happy, Philadelphia's recreational project for children. More than 10,000 of them, red, yellow, and green of various flavors, were dropped from an airplane into the midst of gleeful youngsters who scrambled for as many as they could hold. Guess you're out of luck if you wanted a blue one. Our third story appeared on page 6 of the Lethbridge Herald on January 24th of 1935. Headline reads, "Gets Axe Handle Caught in Mustache." What are the chances of that, huh? And I think there's a typo here. It says Pattsfield, Massachusetts. I believe that should be Pittsfield, Massachusetts. January 24th, Canadian Press. What a mustache, what a man. Peter Dolger of West Stockbridge stopped at a doctor's office to have a severe gash in his leg treated. He said he lost control of an axe when the handle caught in his mustache, which he had allowed to grow to an unusual length. After seeing the doctor, Dolger went to a barbershop and had the handlebars trimmed. Probably a good move on his part. This next story appeared on the front page of the Detroit Free Press on November 10th of 1947. The headline reads, "A woman says, some women too ape-like for high heels." San Francisco Associated Press. Some women haven't evolved sufficiently from their ape-like ancestors to wear high heels with comfort, says Dr. Francis Baker, University of California orthopedic surgeon. Dr. Baker backs up her statement with a mass of clinical evidence in a report in the Archives of Physical Medicine. She says 75% of her female foot patients are that way. Dr. Baker didn't drag in the ape-like connection in so many words. What she said was that many women have, quote, a slight hereditary deformity, unquote, due to, quote, a slight failure of evolution in some families, unquote. This deformity is a turning inward of the fore part of the foot, medically called metatarsus primus varus. In man's monkey-like ancestors, Dr. Baker explained, the inturning of the forefoot was natural, but in the course of evolution it gradually disappeared as the ape man slowly learned to stand and walk erect. It has been entirely eliminated from the modern normal human foot, she said. Well, I guess I won't be wearing any high heels anytime soon. And our last little tidbit for today was printed on page 4 of the Los Angeles Times on August 2nd of 1951. The headline reads, "Gem of a Wash, Boy Locked in with Jewelry Worth Million." That would be about $12 million today. Paul Levin, 16, of 1741 Marvine Avenue, was locked in with more than $1 million worth of jewelry last night because he went to wash his hands. Paul is a stock boy hired last Friday to help with an inventory sale at a jewelry store at 761 South Broadway. At 2 minutes of 6 last night, Paul went to wash his hands. When he came out of the washroom, he was the only person in the store. An hour and a half later, Paul was released by a store official and sent home to a belated dinner. So earlier in the podcast, I'd asked you about Elvis's biggest hit on Billboard's Hot 100 singles chart. Now, I had asked this question at a talk that I gave a couple of weeks ago at Hudson Valley Community College, and the audience offered up a lot of great answers, you know, like Hound Dog, Blue Suede Shoes, and Jailhouse Rock, but no one hit upon the correct answer. So do you think you know it? Of course, in his day, Elvis was a superstar. He was the first person to have 100 songs make the chart, actually 109 in total, 25 of them reached the top 10, and 7 went all the way to number 1. Now, the last of those number 1 songs was 1969 Suspicious Minds, but that is not the answer. While Suspicious Minds hit number 1, it only ranks 21st on Billboard's list of his most successful songs. So here, in order, are his top 5 singles. Coming in at number 5 is Can't Help Falling in Love from 1961. Number 4 was Don't Be Cruel from 1956. 1960s It's Now or Never ranks as number 3. The classic Jailhouse Rock comes in at number 2. And topping the list is his monster smash hit, All Shook Up, which clocks in at a brief 1 minute and 57 seconds. In fact, most of his songs were in the 2 to 2.5 minute range at that time. That song hit number 1 on April 13th of 1957 and stayed there for 9 weeks. The song also stayed at number 1 for 4 weeks on Billboard's R&B chart, as well as topping its country chart. And with sales in excess of 2 million copies, It was named Billboard's year-end number one song for all of 1957. Well, I do hope you enjoyed that collection of stories. My favorite was the story about the mummified Anderson McCrew. And while I was in the middle of recording that, my cockatiel Mo, who had been sleeping, she suddenly started screaming, then she took flight like a maniac around the room, back and forth, and then crash, she landed just below the window. Then, seconds later, my wife Mary Jane, who was upstairs, yelled something, but I couldn't understand what she was saying because my bird was screaming. So she came down and asked me if I felt the earthquake, and my response was, "What earthquake?" But of course, that explained Mo's sudden flight of terror. I quickly checked online, and the United States Geological Survey showed, sure enough, that a magnitude 4.8 earthquake had struck New Jersey, and I missed it totally. On another note, and this has nothing to do with earthquakes, Google recently shut down their podcast app, so I had no choice but to switch my feed over to YouTube. So you can now listen to all the episodes of this podcast on YouTube. I should point out it's just a static image. It's not me and there's no images flying by. It's just a static image, but you can listen to the audio there. Just a reminder, you can find the Useless Information podcast wherever you get your podcasts, so be sure to subscribe. And while you have your favorite podcast app open, I'd greatly appreciate it if you could leave a positive review of this podcast, because that really does help to bring in new listeners. You can also follow the podcast on Facebook and X, which will forever be Twitter in my mind. If you'd like to contact me for any reason, my email is steve@uselessinformation.org, and there is also a contact form on my website, uselessinformation.org. The Useless Information Podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, so be sure to visit airwavemedia.com, and there you will find a curated selection of some of the best podcasts out there. As always, thanks for listening, and take care, everyone. Bye.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that because you're already listening to a podcast.